Welcome to Lies.com podcast number 2. This program, which I'm recording on Sunday, May 15th, 2005, will feature a half hour or so of music, found audio, and mostly commentary by me, John Callender, creator of Lies.com. This week's commentary includes a look at ongoing developments with the secret Tony Blair memo on Iraq, some observations on the false alarm involving that wayward Cessna over Washington, a discussion of whether Iraq has become a failed state and what it means if it has, a musical interlude to mark the anniversary of Bush's weird Abu Ghraib speech impediment. Then, in non-Bush news, we'll have a look back at the Spanish-American War, Teddy Roosevelt, and Mark Twain's short story, The War Prayer. And finally, Chicago's Virgin Mary water stain. So, with that out of the way, it's time for this week's Bush bashing. I talked in my last podcast, which was also my first podcast, about the memo summarizing the meeting Tony Blair held on Iraq on July 22, 2002, which was leaked to and printed by the Sunday Times of London a few weeks ago. Since then, I've run a few follow-up items about the memo and the reaction to it. The first of those items, which I ran on Wednesday, focused on the odd, to me, failure of the U.S. media to report on the memo, which seems to contain pretty clear evidence that Bush was being dishonest during the summer of 2002, when he was still publicly saying that he hadn't made up his mind to go to war. Joe Connison provided some valuable context for the memo in his Slate column, where he quoted Bush's statements at his October 16th news conference accompanying the signing of the Congressional Use of Force Resolution. Let's use the Wayback Machine and listen to a few key sections of that speech.
With this resolution, Congress has now authorized the use of force. I have not ordered the use of force. I hope the use of force will not become necessary. Yet confronting the threat posed by Iraq is necessary by whatever means that requires. Either the Iraqi regime will give up its weapons of mass destruction, or for the sake of peace, the United States will lead a global coalition to disarm that regime. If any doubt, our nation's resolve, our determination, they would be unwise to test it. Our goal is not merely to limit Iraq's violations of Security Council resolutions or to slow down its weapons program. Our goal is to fully and finally remove a real threat to world peace and to America. Hopefully this can be done peacefully. Hopefully we can do this without any military action. Yet if Iraq is to avoid military action by the international community, it has the obligation to prove compliance with all the world's demands. It's the obligation of Iraq.
So there's Bush maintaining in October 2002 that he hasn't made an irrevocable decision to go to war with Iraq. His stated willingness to give Saddam one more chance to comply with UN weapons inspectors was a key part of the case he'd made to Congress to get that use of force resolution. But the Blair memo, which again had been written 3 months earlier, contradicts that. Based on meetings he'd had in Washington, the head of MI6 was telling Tony Blair that, quote, there was a perceptible shift in attitude. Military action was now seen as inevitable, unquote. And it seemed clear that Bush had made up his mind to take military action. So, there's a contradiction there. Now, it's a contradiction in name only, because people like me, who opposed Bush's Iraq policy, were pretty sure back then that he'd already decided to go to war, and the last chance he was offering Saddam to comply with the weapons inspectors was really just a fig leaf. In early 2003, when Saddam essentially did comply with the weapons inspectors and Bush chose to launch the invasion anyway, we had all the proof we needed that that view was correct. But Bush's supporters continue to excuse his actions to this day to say that, no, Bush was sincere in his offering Saddam a final chance to comply, that it was Saddam who was responsible for Bush's reluctant decision to launch the war. It's the same story with the faulty intelligence on Iraqi weapons of mass destruction. The fact that there turned out not to be any WMD, again, wasn't Bush's fault, they say. That his supporters continue to cling to that position, despite the mountains of evidence that there was a systematic effort by the Bush team to skew the intelligence to provide support for the war, is really remarkable to me. And again, with the Blair memo, that mountain of evidence just got higher. Quoting from it some more, Bush wanted to remove Saddam through military action, justified by the conjunction of terrorism and WMD, but the intelligence and facts were being fixed around the policy. And, later, Saddam was not threatening his neighbors, and his WMD capability was less than that of Libya, North Korea, or Iran. We should work up a plan for an ultimatum to Saddam to allow back in the UN weapons inspectors. This would also help with the legal justification for the use of force. Now, this is the non-BS version of what Bush was doing in the summer of 2002, and it fits perfectly with the events as they actually played out afterward. That plan was worked up. Bush and Blair did present Saddam with an ultimatum in an effort to build the legal justification for the use of force. A week ago, on May 6th, 88 congresspeople, led by the dangerously non-Republican John Conyers of Michigan, released the text of a letter they had sent to Bush about the Blair memo. The letter contained the following questions. Do you or anyone in your administration dispute the accuracy of the leaked document? Were arrangements being made, including the recruitment of allies, before you sought congressional authorization to go to war? Did you or anyone in your administration obtain Britain's commitment to invade prior to this time? Was there an effort to create an ultimatum about weapons inspectors in order to help with the justification for the war, as the minutes indicate? At what point in time did you and Prime Minister Blair first agree it was necessary to invade Iraq? And was there a coordinated effort with the U.S. intelligence community and/or British officials to fix the intelligence and facts around the policy, as the leaked document states? Those are some good questions. So far, the Bush administration has simply made no answer. At first, it was really aggravating to me how the mainstream media in this country were failing to talk about all this, but it looks like that might be changing. Knight Ritter did a story on it, then CNN and a few papers ran a brief item mentioning the Conyers letter in the middle of the week, and on Friday, Walter Pincus had a nice detailed article in the Washington Post, albeit on page 18. So here's hoping the pressure keeps building, to the point where the Bush team feels compelled to start offering explanations. Then we can play the game of comparing today's explanation to yesterday's, and to the one from the day before that. Collect the inconsistencies. Trade them with your friends. Because I've been looking, in vain so far, for a reporter to bring up the Blair memo with Bush Press Secretary Scott McClellan, I've been reading the transcripts and sometimes watching the videos of the daily White House press briefings. They post them at whitehouse.gov, and I have to give the Bush people credit. The information there is really useful, and it's presented more or less consistently and accurately. There was some grumbling a year or two ago, if I recall, about some of the information supposedly being censored after the fact, but as far as I can remember, that actually turned out to be an innocent case of technical ineptitude rather than a nefarious plot. Whatever you may think about my just being a reflexive Bush hater, the fact is that I've got a real soft spot for anyone who can mount a content-rich and not-too-user-hostile collection of web-based information. So, props to the Bush web team. But anyway, in looking through those briefings, there was a funny little drama that played out over the last several days concerning the aftermath of those guys who accidentally flew a Cessna over D.C., prompting evacuations of the Capitol and the White House. There were actually two things about that that struck me as funny, or at least interesting. First was the way the reporters kept pounding on McClellan about just how close the plane got to the White House, and just who was in the loop and authorized to give the order to shoot it down, and just how the notification of evacuation was made to different people in the different locations. And at first I couldn't figure out why they were being so persistent. I mean, they were acting like real journalists, asking all those follow-up questions and really putting their good pal Scotty on the spot when he wasn't being forthcoming with the details they wanted. And then it hit me. The reporters weren't asking about petty things like nuclear proliferation and state-sanctioned torture and illegal wars. No, they were talking about their own personal safety. Those reporters were in those buildings when the plane flew over, and for once they couldn't have cared less about preserving their access and not making waves. They wanted answers, dammit, and they weren't going away until they got them. So it was nice to see that they could still do that, at least in certain circumstances. The second interesting thing was the whole back and forth about Bush's notification, or rather his non-notification. Because it turns out that when the plane flew over, Bush was out on a mountain bike ride, getting in some exercise after his trip to Russia. And while people were being evacuated from the Capitol and the White House, and terror alert levels were cascading up into the start shooting things down range, and the President's Secret Service guys were being kept aware of what was going on, no one actually interrupted the President's bike ride to tell him any of this until 36 minutes after the plane had been diverted and the all-clear had been given. Let's listen in while the press pool tries to get McClellan to acknowledge the obvious, that this at least looks bad. These are just the highlights, by the way. The whole exchange takes up most of the press briefing.
Scott, yesterday the White House was on red alert, was evacuated. The First Lady, Nancy Reagan, were taken to a secure location. The Vice President was evacuated from the grounds. The Capitol building was evacuated. The continuity of government plan was initiated. And yet the president wasn't told of yesterday's events until after he finished his bike ride, about 36 minutes after the all clear had been sent. Is he satisfied with the fact that he wasn't notified about this?
Yes, and I think you just brought up a very good point. The protocols that were in place after September 11th were followed. The president was never considered to be in danger because he was at an off-site location. The president has a tremendous amount of trust in his Secret Service detail. The Secret Service detail that was traveling with the president was being kept apprised of the situation as it was developing. They were in close contact with officials back here at the White House, and the president appreciates the job that they do.
The fact that the president wasn't in danger is one aspect of this, but he's also the commander-in-chief. There was a military operation underway. Other people were in contact with the White House. Shouldn't the commander-in-chief have been notified of what was going on?
John, the protocols that we put in place after September 11th were being followed.
Scott.
Go ahead, Kelly.
Thank you. Isn't there
You're
an
welcome.
Appearance? Thank you. I appreciate that. Isn't there a bit of an appearance problem, notwithstanding the president's safety was not in question, protocols were followed, that today, looking at it, he was enjoying a bike ride, and that recreation time was not considered expendable to inform him of this? Isn't there just
John mentioned 36 problem. Minutes after the all clear. Remember, this was a matter of minutes when all this was happening. The all clear was given at 12:14 p.m. and it had gone down to yellow a few minutes before that as well. So again, you have to take into account the circumstances. You have to take into account where the president is. The president was never considered to be in danger. The protocols that we put in place after September 11th, I think, worked.
Is he on any protocol to be informed at any point? Is there a protocol that involves when he's informed?
Of course, and he has been in the past, Ellen.
Steve.
Let's stay on this subject since there seems to be interest in this subject. Now, go ahead.
I think there's a disconnect here because, I mean, yesterday you had more than 30,000 people who were evacuated. You had millions of people who were watching this on television, and there was a sense at some point, it was a short window, a 15-minute window, but there was a sense of confusion among some on the streets. There was a sense of fear. And people are wondering, you know, was this not a moment for the president to exercise some leadership, some guidance during that period of time? Was this not a missed opportunity for the president to speak out and at least clarify that he was informed and what was taking place at that time? If not even during the 15-minute window, why not later in the day?
The president did lead, and the president did that after September 11th when we put the protocols in place to make sure that situations like this were addressed before it was too late. And that was the case in this situation. And in terms of during this time, this was a matter of minutes when this was occurring, and all the appropriate security personnel and Homeland Security officials and others were acting to implement those protocols. And we commend all those that worked to follow those protocols and make sure that this situation was addressed, and it worked in terms of the protocols.
Scott, but beyond the protocols here, I mean, we're talking about just simply demonstrating to the American people, I understand what's taking place, we are in control of the situation, and I've been apprised of what is happening here, because there were thousands of people involved in what was a very scary moment.
We briefed you about the circumstances of the event shortly after that, but during that time period, it's important in those minutes when this is occurring, that everybody's focused on making sure that people in the area of the threat are protected. And there are protocols in place to make sure that the people in the area of the threat are protected. Those protocols were followed. You all covered this, and you all covered this on the coverage last night and pointed out how those protocols were followed and how jets were scrambled. This was an instance where presidential authority was not required because we had put these protocols in place after September 11th.
The reason this issue resonates, of course, is that it evokes the emotional response we all had on September 11th, when a much bigger crisis seemed to be going on and on and on with no sign of Bush's leadership. I'm not saying there's anything wrong with the protocols and the actions that were taken in this case. On the contrary, I think everyone probably performed their jobs ably and effectively. But I still feel compelled to point out McClellan's efforts to spin things in order to minimize the damage to Bush's reputation as a leader. Jason, whom you may know from his postings and comments on lies.com, made the following comment to me when I was griping about this. So you would have been happier if the president would have grabbed a Stinger missile, shot down the Cessna, taken a piss on the smoldering wreckage, and said, "Get off my lawn!" Look, I realize that the world doesn't work that way. But I still think it's significant that Bush, far from embodying that kind of Harrison Ford chief executive, is actually more or less at the opposite end of the spectrum. In a crisis, he's pretty much the last person the professionals want to have involved. Not just because he wouldn't be much help, though I suppose that's true too, but because his uncoached reactions would make it much more difficult for his political team to patch things up afterward, to maintain the illusion that he's the kind of guy who can analyze a lot of complex data and make good decisions in real time. That's just not the kind of guy Bush is. But that's the kind of guy Americans want for a president. So Bush's handlers work really hard to try to make him look like that. I think that's why they were willing to risk wiring him with a radio receiver for the debates with Kerry. Because in terms of the uphill battle they face in selling Bush to the public, the stakes were that high. But rehearsals and teleprompters and flattering camera angles and hidden earpieces can only do so much. Every once in a while something like this comes along, and there's just no hiding the reality. It's the man behind the curtain moment from The Wizard of Oz, the little boy shouting out the truth about the Emperor's new clothes. All they can do is cover it up as quick as they can and change the subject, hoping we'll forget what we saw. Meanwhile, things are blowing up in Iraq. I mean, a lot. It seems we can add the Iraqi elections to the fall of Saddam and the handing over of sovereignty in the list of events that were supposed to magically usher in the new age of Iraqi security, but that have failed to do so. University of Michigan history professor Juan Cole, a perpetual source of informed comment on the Middle East via his cleverly titled weblog, Informed Comment, said this last week about the ongoing bombings. Few commentators, when they mention such news, point out the obvious. The United States military does not control Baghdad. It doesn't control the major roads leading out of the capital. It does not control the downtown area, except possibly the heavily barricaded Green Zone. It does not control the capital. The guerrillas strike at will, even at Iraqi notables who can afford American security guards, many of them, e.g., ex-Navy SEALs. If the U.S. military does not control the capital of a country it conquered, then it controls nothing of importance. Ipso facto, Iraq is a failed state. This recalls former counterterrorism czar Richard Clark's analysis on how the newly arrived Bush administration threw out all the counterterrorism doctrine that had been developed during the Clinton years, which recognized that an important threat to our security came not from traditional hostile states, but from so-called failed states like Somalia and Afghanistan, which served as havens and breeding grounds for transnational terrorists. The Bush people wanted to go back to working the same problems they'd been working during the Reagan and Bush 1 years, nuclear missile defense and the toppling of rogue regimes. That was sexy. Clinton-style nation-building and counterterrorism was dull. But, as it turns out, it was only effective counterterrorism that was dull. Ineffective counterterrorism, Bush-style, is a recipe for non-stop excitement, and we've got a front-row seat for oodles and oodles of it in Iraq, not just now, but for years to come. Abu Ghraib has been in the news lately, what with the ongoing grinding of the wheels of military justice through the low-level enlisted folk who were unfortunate enough to be caught on film, carrying out the administration's non-policy of conducting non-torture of non-captives to obtain non-information. I'm not going to talk about that, though. Instead, I'm going to celebrate the one-year anniversary of one of the weirder aspects of the whole Abu Ghraib story, the way Bush persisted in mispronouncing the name of the prison whenever he felt compelled to mention it in public. Here's Bush speaking on Iraq at the Army War College in Pennsylvania on May 26, 2004.
A new Iraq will also need a humane, well-supervised prison system. Under the dictator, prisons like Abu Ghraib were symbols of death and torture. That same prison became a symbol of disgraceful conduct by a few American troops who dishonored our country and disregarded our values. America will fund the construction of a modern maximum security prison. When that prison is completed, detainees at Abu Ghraib will be relocated. Then, with the approval of the Iraqi government, we will demolish the Abu Ghraib prison as a fitting symbol of Iraq's new beginning.
And here's Bush speaking at a Q&A with the visiting Hungarian Prime Minister on June 22nd.
Thank you. Scott.
Thank you, Mr. President. Secretary Rumsfeld expressed some concern last week that a perception might be taking hold that your administration had condoned or authorized torture of prisoners. Specifically, you worried that might give other countries an excuse to torture American civilians, American soldiers, wondering if that's what prompted you to release these memos, these documents, and your deliberations, and also, do you think we need an independent commission to defend the culture?
Right. Let me make very clear the position of my government.
in our country. We do not condone torture. I have never ordered torture. I will never order torture. The values of this country are such that torture is not a part of our soul and our being. The Prime Minister brought up the Abu Ghraib situation. I assured him that these soldiers do not represent what Americans think.
I really can't say what's going on with that. It's not like nuclear, where Bush is pretty clearly making a conscious ploy to appeal to voters who share that regional mispronunciation with him. I can't think it bought Bush any points with red state voters that he couldn't say the name of the Iraqi prison at the center of one of the biggest scandals of the war, though I suppose it didn't hurt him much either. No, I think it was probably just an actual speech impediment, perhaps enhanced by his conflicted emotions about the scandal, which makes me feel like a bit of a jerk for fixating on it. At least I'm not the only one. There's Michael Fisher of m-fisher.com, for example, who was inspired to create this catchy little tune called Prison System. Check it out.
A new Iraq will also need a humane... A new Iraq will also need a humane, well-supervised... Prison system. Prison system. Prison system. Prison system. Symbols of death and torture. Symbols of death and torture. Under the dictator, prisons like a new Iraq will also need a humane, well-supervised prison system. Under the dictator, prisons like a new Iraq will also need a humane, well-supervised prison system. Prisons like Abu Ghraib. Prisons like Abu Ghraib. Prisons like Abu Ghraib. Prison system. Prison system. A humane, well-supervised dictator. Prison system. A humane, well-supervised dictator. Prison system. Dishonored our country and disregarded our values.
Lying via the news media to whip up popular support for an aggressive war of conquest is something that really bugs me, obviously. It's profoundly incompatible with the principles of liberty and democracy on which this country was founded. But I have to admit that it's also something that has happened again and again in U.S. history. I've been reading lately about the Spanish-American War, which some view as the first real example of this sort of thing, the conflict that marked the end of U.S. isolationism and the emergence of the U.S. as a player on an equal footing with the imperial powers of Europe. This was the war that was brought about in large part by the yellow journalism of William Randolph Hearst's newspapers, the Fox News of their day, in the pages of which slanted and in many cases outright fictional accounts were presented as objective news in order to manipulate public opinion. By the time Hearst was done trumpeting the horrible evil of Spain's blowing up the steamship Maine in Havana Harbor, remember the Maine? Public anger was running so high that President McKinley felt he had no choice but to go to war, even if, as was suspected by more thoughtful observers at the time, and as is generally accepted by historians today, Spain had nothing to gain by blowing up the ship, and the explosion was more likely the result of a boiler room accident or maybe an act of sabotage by Cuban guerrillas bent on drawing the U.S. into their conflict with Spain. The Spanish-American War also made Teddy Roosevelt a household name. Roosevelt's leading of the Rough Riders in the assault on San Juan Hill, as described in newspaper dispatches penned by the writer Roosevelt employed to accompany him into battle, were hugely popular, establishing him immovably in the public mind as the very embodiment of heroism and manly virtue, and playing a major role in his election as president a few years later. The other day I came across a really cool web archive of old wax cylinder audio recordings at tinfoil.com. I want to play for you one of the oldest items in it. Made in 1898, the same year as the attack on San Juan Hill, it's a studio recreation of that event, with bugle calls, stirring music, and faux gunfire, and ending with cheers for the brave heroes, Teddy Roosevelt and the Rough Riders. Yeah, the production values aren't much by modern standards, and the special effects are pretty cheesy, but it's an historic piece. This could well be the very first time that a non-print media technology was used to present a glorified version of battle. In that sense, it's the forerunner of all the propaganda films, Hollywood war movies, and armed forces recruiting commercials that followed. You could also view it as the forerunner of all non-print political advertising, the first feel-good multimedia puff piece, Morning in America, and all that. Anyway, let's listen.
This could be selection, the charge of Roosevelt's Rough Riders, played by Columbia Orchestra, for Columbia Photographs from New York and Paris. Assembly! To arms!
As I said, the Spanish-American War was hugely popular in the U.S. But even at the height of war fever, there were those who remained opposed. One of them was Mark Twain, whose short story, The War Prayer, was written in response to the events of that time, though it wasn't published until after his death. In the story, Twain describes a generic town in the heartland of America at the outset of the war. Flags were flying, volunteers marched down the street to the cheer of onlookers, and on a Sunday, just before shipping out, the soldiers and townsfolk gather in church to hear a preacher offer a prayer for their victory in battle. And as the prayer is being spoken, a stranger, tall, ghoulishly pale, with white hair and a long robe, enters the church and walks slowly up the aisle. He stands next to the preacher, who, his eyes closed and arms raised in his fervor, doesn't notice the new arrival. When the preacher finishes his prayer, saying, "Grant us the victory, O Lord our God, Father and Protector of our land and flag," the newcomer touches his arm and motions him away, then takes his place and looks out at the congregation. He tells them that he has come bearing a message from God. "He has heard the prayer of his servant, your shepherd, and will grant it if such shall be your desire, after I, his messenger, shall have explained to you its import," that is to say, its full import. The messenger goes on to explain that, as with many prayers, there was an unspoken component to it that God also heard. He tells the congregation, "You have heard your servant's prayer, the uttered part of it. I'm commissioned of God to put into words the other part of it, that part which the pastor, and also you in your hearts, fervently prayed silently." And then he speaks the following prayer. "O Lord our Father, our young patriots, idols of our hearts, go forth to battle. Be thou near them. With them in spirit we also go forth from the sweet peace of our beloved firesides to smite the foe. O Lord our God, help us to tear their soldiers to bloody shreds with our shells. Help us to cover their smiling fields with the pale forms of their patriot dead. Help us to drown the thunder of the guns with the shrieks of their wounded writhing in pain. Help us to lay waste their humble homes with a hurricane of fire. Help us to wring the hearts of their unoffending widows with unavailing grief. Help us to turn them out roofless with little children, to wander unfriended the wastes of their desolated land in rags and hunger and thirst, sports of the sun flames of summer and the icy winds of winter, broken in spirit, worn with travail, imploring thee for the refuge of the grave and denied it. For our sakes who adore thee, Lord, blast their hopes, blight their lives, protract their bitter pilgrimage, make heavy their steps, water their way with their tears, stain the white snow with the blood of their wounded feet. We ask it in the spirit of love, of him who is the source of love, and who is the ever-faithful refuge and friend of all that are sore beset and seek his aid with humble and contrite hearts. Amen." After a pause, "Ye have prayed it. If ye still desire it, speak. The messenger of the Most High waits." It was believed afterward that the man was a lunatic, because there was no sense in what he said. Religion exerts a powerful emotional pull on me. The truth that is at the heart of the world's great religions is a truth, and I believe it is the same truth in all of them, encrusted though it is with the obscuring differences that arise from our failure to understand, is a truth that I'm morally bound to strive for, to reflect in my own life. So I'm sympathetic to people whose faith leads them in mystical directions, whose belief in divine magic leads them to expect, and then to see, miracles. But even so, this story gives me pause. I'm talking about the image of the Virgin Mary that many believers, Catholic believers, presumably, have said they see in the water stain surrounding a vertical crack in the cement wall beneath a Chicago overpass. It's been on TV a bunch in the last few weeks. The story represents an interesting inversion of the way I often feel like I'm the first in line for news, like the item with which I began this podcast about the secret Tony Blair memo, which I've been following in the British press for a while, but which is only now starting to show up in this country. But with this water stain story, I didn't know about it until people who watch more mainstream TV than I do started talking about it and linking to it from their weblogs. Anyway, the stain is certainly evocative of Renaissance paintings of the Virgin Mary, in a hazy Rorschach kind of way. But for people to actually believe it was put there by God as a sign to the faithful, for them to make pilgrimages to it, lay offerings before it, weep as they press their hands against the wall next to it, makes me step back and say, whoa. The childlike simplicity of their belief, their acceptance of the idea that an anthropomorphic deity chooses to spend his time miraculously bringing forth vague approximations of centuries-old Catholic iconography, makes me realize that one of two things must be true. Either those people are profoundly different than me, in which case I inhabit a world filled with large numbers of pod people who are frighteningly out of touch with reality, or, and this is the more likely explanation, I think, they are not profoundly different than me, and their ludicrous belief in the magical significance of a random water stain is no different than any number of sincere but equally ludicrous beliefs of my own. I just lack the perspective to see how ludicrous those beliefs of mine are. Either way, scary. That's it for Lies.com podcast number 2. Thanks to George Bush, Tony Blair, Joe Connison, John Conyers, Knight Ridder, CNN, Walter Pincus and The Washington Post, Scott McClellan, Helen Thomas, Juan Cole, and Richard Clark. Thanks also to Tinfoil.com, the Columbia Orchestra, Teddy Roosevelt and the Rough Riders, Wikipedia, Mark Twain, the Virgin Mary, and Dave Weiner. Regarding the music you've heard in this podcast, the track Prison System was created by Michael Fisher and is used with his permission. For more information about his music, see his website at m-fisher.com. Last but not least, I'd like to thank all my fellow obsessives from Lies.com, including Sven, Craig, Jason, Ethan P., Hossman, Wymat, Robert, Enkidu, and Omnigrog. This copyrighted podcast is distributed under the Creative Commons license. See my website at www.lies.com/podcast for details, including links to the websites and musical artists I've mentioned. I'm John Callender. Thanks for listening.